Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Exploration 1, Module 2. This is the lecture we should have had last week, and this is the lecture that we're pretty much going to rip through, and then we're going to talk about all of the other stuff. I mean, how does everybody feel about the contents of Module 2? Do you want me to talk about what a protocol is and all that sort of good stuff? Because I can, and I have no problem doing it. But I mean, you guys are pretty clever. You guys are a pretty clever bunch. So, how does everybody feel about Module 2?
Jason, as I said, as I was mentioning before we started recording, I think I'm okay with that. It's more just figuring out the OSI and TCP models and how the layers sort of interconnect with each other and interrelate is the only part that I'm. And I'll get it. It's just, you know, not quite stuck in my head yet.
Yeah, this is Corey. I agree there. The OSI model is definitely one that need to work on a bit more. I also I know there's an extension on the labs. However, I did press ahead and try to complete those to the best of my ability, and I was able to do so. Did install, you know, the T-Shark and was able to mess around with that a bit. What's the other name of that other application? It's escaping me right now. Smart Sniffer. That one I got for sure. But there was a couple questions on the end of the lab that I didn't quite understand, so that gives you an idea where I'm at when I got into talking about, I believe it's the last two or three questions on the lab.
That would require me to remember what they were. So if you can actually tell me what they were, I'll be happy to answer.
Sure. Because I've got. Hang on, I'll pull it up while you can.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I mean, I've actually just opened my notes because what I actually want to do is I want to rip through this chapter really quickly so that I know I've covered it and you all know that I've covered it, and then if anybody has any clarifications on this, because my first mandate is to actually cover what's in the chapter. This should take us about. Well, it depends on how much discussion we get into, 10 or 15 minutes, and then we're going to get on to the other things. Anybody else got any input they want? Am I right to start on this Module 2 stuff?
I think you're good.
Yep.
Oh, I don't know whether I'd ever say that I'm good, but okay, let's get started. Okay. They're pretty simple notes, these ones. You guys have probably all read them. A network needs a sender, a receiver, and a medium. A medium being the thing that the data has travelled across, not that strange robed woman at the fair that you pay lots of money out to find out whether you're actually going to get even more money next week in the lottery draw. Okay, so we have a sender, we have a receiver, we have a medium. There are situations where you can have a sender to multiple receivers and you can have multiple senders to one receiver, and we're not covering that. But we're all cool with the fact that we need a sender, a receiver, and a medium. That sounds pretty good to me. Now, people would be aware. Is everybody familiar with the difference between circuit switched and packet switched networks?
Yes.
No.
No. Well, let's clarify that, because that's important. In fact, it's crucially important. All right. Everybody here used a telephone? Of course you all have, right? You pick up the telephone and you dial some numbers, and some amazing magic goes on in the telephone exchange, and then your significant other answers at the other end of the phone and tells you not to forget the milk. So, sorry, my sensitivity just dropped out. That is what we call a circuit switched network. Let's not go into how they're actually shoveling stuff over digital stuff on new telephone networks. That will completely break my analysis. So, do I need to reduce my sensitivity? Is this dropping out for you guys as well? Because I'm having trouble with it losing.
It's dropping a bit.
Yeah, okay. Right. Yeah. Hey, it's Kerry back in the office after a week. It's got to have a little bit of fail going on here. Let's see what we can do. Okay, let's try that. 1, 2, guff, wibble, blah. Okay, so you ring up, you pick up a phone, you dial some numbers, some incredible magic goes on at the telephone exchange. I'm liking this much better. And once you've done that, your significant other answers the phone and you open what we call a circuit. There is a circuit between your phone and the phone of your significant other. We'll assume, given the contents of the current group, that the significant other is, by high probability, female, just because it'll make my examples easier. If that's not the case, I'm terribly sorry. We're moving on. So you've rung her up. You've opened a circuit up. You have spoken to her about whatever it is you're talking to her about, and you have hung up the call, and the circuit is closed. Now, obviously, if a trench digger drives through the phone line somewhere between you and your significant other, your call is going to be cut off and dropped and destroyed. Everybody cool with that concept? That, you know, if you break this circuit, she's not going to be able to tell you to remember the milk. Alrighty. This is what we call a circuit switch network. In other words, when you establish a call from one point in the network to the other point, you establish a circuit between the two endpoints. How the circuits are routed depends on how the network is actually implemented. So this is how the networks in the 50s and 60s were put together. And when you dialed up different things, depending on what capacity we've got, is, you know, you had various levels of network capacity. Now, everybody had situations where, like on Christmas time or whatever, you would actually dial a number because you wanted to ring your family, and you'd be told that your call was unsuccessful, please hang up and call back again, that sort of stuff. In other words, no circuit capacity to carry your call.
Still happens.
It sometimes does. And so, I mean, if you look at a small office, for example, say, for example, you're running a small office at Chips and Bits, and you've got two outbound lines. If the secretary's on one of them and you're on the other, and the sales guy wants to call out, you're not going to get a call out. Yeah, you're going to exceed line capacity. Now, there's a problem with circuit switching. And the problem is that if you actually have a circuit break, you basically have to hang up the call that you made and re-establish the call, which is hopefully routed via a new circuit. And in fact, depending on how the network's designed and which circuit's actually smashed, that either may or may not be possible. So you can see that for a circuit switch network, you must have sufficient number of concurrent circuits to hold the number of concurrent conversations that you intend to have at any one time. This means lots of wires, lots of cables, lots of circuits, quite expensive. Everybody cool with that?
Yep.
And if I'm being too simplistic and stupid, somebody just shoot me and I'll move on faster. But so basically what happened in the 60s was they did some research at DARPA and they decided to invent what we call packet-switched networks. Now, when a message is broken down to be sent over a data network, it stands to reason that it's converted somehow into binary information, and then that binary information is shoveled over a medium. So whether it's shoveled over using wireless, electrical current, optical fiber, light. We haven't figured out how to do the internet over psychic energy yet, but we're working on it. I know, you all knew I was going to say that. Obviously, you've got to get the message from one point to another. Now, what actually happens is that the network stream of information, whether it be an email or whether it be a voice call or whatever, is broken down into a number of what we call protocol data units, which is a funky sort of name that explains what each of the different units is, so that they can be understood by the various levels of protocols that run at the various layers. Okay, so while we're on Ventrilo here, my voice is being separated into a whole pile of packets that have got anywhere between, you know, 70 or 80 bytes and about, you know, 1300, 1400 bytes of information. They are being shoveled and they are being routed over the internet, and then the stream is being reassembled at the other end. There are two advantages to this. Multiple conversations and multiple ways of and multiple paths for redundancy. Okay? So if you look at your home network, for example, just a home network, you might have a router that connects you to the internet, to your internet service. And you might, for example, have... You might only have one link to the internet. So when your cable company goes down or whatever you're using, you have no internet. When, if for example, you were to set up a 3G modem, you might be able to have a solution where you had your internet most of the time, and then when the cable company's link fell out, which it does on stormy nights, you would then have the 3G modem. So this is known as redundancy. I'm sure people have seen these sorts of solutions. Sorry, somebody keyed up. Did you guys want to say something? Feel free to key your name into chat if you want to interrupt me. Okay, now the message is broken up into segments and packets and all sorts of things, and they're all different names for these different things, but at the moment we're going to call them segments. So, let's say, for example, you are on your computer and you have an email application open and you have a web browser open. Can anybody apart from Chris, who's disqualified for answering this one because I definitely know that he knows the answer, tell me how does your computer differentiate between multiple configuration, multiple communications, multiple concurrent communications? What are the things that differentiate between those?
It's port numbers.
We had port numbers. I didn't hear what the other person said, but yeah.
Protocol.
Yeah, definitely protocols. What actually happens is everybody knows that a machine is usually allocated one or more unique IPv4 addresses, which are 32 bits long. They are considered unique on the local network that they are configured on. And then they are going to... they're also going to be able to talk to other machines using those IP addresses. I don't want to get into network address translation at the moment because we haven't got there yet, but we're assuming that your computers have got various IP addresses, and if you want to send files from one of your machines to one of your other machines, you're going to talk from its IP address to the other IP address in a vastly oversimplified manner, and the files are going to get from one machine to the other. Now, one of the problems is that if you segment these networks up and segment these data streams up and break them into little packets, whilst you gain the benefits of error correction, error detection, the ability to multiplex communications on a communications channel, you do incur overhead. So rather than sending the, 20,000 bytes of your message, you're going to have to send the 24,000 bytes of your message plus the overhead for the segmentation, which Cisco puts around anywhere between 5 and 10% for TCP/IP overhead. Any questions so far, and am I making any sense? Okay. All right. Sorry, if I'm too fast, somebody tell me to slow down. And if you don't understand something, tell me to slow down. But I'd rather get through stuff as quickly as I can so that we can get to talking about fun stuff. Okay, a process is a thing that gets things to happen on network. Anybody willing to open a command prompt and run a command? Because I love this exercise and it's lots of fun. You will need a command prompt. Windows R, CMD, or however else you want to get a command prompt on your operating system of choice. I'm hoping that everybody is working on a Windows machine here. If you have a Mac, then you're going to do something different. Now, has anybody ever run netstat, netstat-B?
That B is in Bravo.
Have a little bit. Yeah, that's B is in Bravo. So netstat space dash capital B. I love this command. It's incredibly useful. So I've got an entry here that says TCP chasm colon 1084, which is the source machine name and port number. ECK2 dash blah 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 blah. That's not important. Dot compute. Amazon, one of the Amazon cloud machines. And it's HTTPS, which is the protocol it's using. It's in closed underline wait state, which I'll talk about later in the chapters. 2840, I'm not sure what the 2840 is, I'd have to look that up. And it's brackets dropbox.exe, close bracket. Did everybody get some sort of readable output from their netstat-B?
Yes, looking at it now.
Okay. Who didn't?
Can I just verify... It's Barry here. Can I just verify the syntax?
Oh, it's netstat, N-E-T-S-T-A-T, space, minus B for Bravo... minus capital B for Bravo. I can type that into chat.
It says the requested operation requires elevation.
Oh, yeah, you'll have to run that as administrator,
so
sorry.
Run that as admin, yeah.
Ah, right.
Sorry, I took a long time to populate that.
Yeah, I'll explain why. I'll explain why in a minute. The reason it needs admin privileges is because the dash capital B option to netstat actually shows you which processes have the connections open. So are the connections open by Skype? Are they open by Dropbox? Are they open by Windows Live Messenger? Are they open by whatever? Okay, you guys who are still running UAC, because I'm bad and I'm running Windows XP on this workstation, so I'm not running UAC. For you guys who can run your command prompt as administrator, you should be able to get that to fly, which I think is Control-Enter on the command prompt or something. I can't remember. You may want to make a shortcut to command prompt and change the properties to run as administrator, because I'll probably be occasionally asking you to fire that off. Why did it take so long to populate the list? Very good question. Basically, as Windows was enumerating all of the source sockets and destination sockets, it was actually doing reverse DNS lookups to show you how which names of machines were actually in use. If we go back in here, I think it's netstat-B-D. No. Ah, yes, if you go netstat space dash capital B for Bravo space minus lowercase n, which says no DNS lookups, you'll find that the screen display will come up much more quickly. Any questions about that?
Yeah, a good part of my screen is the process apagent.exe. There's like four or five of those. That's all duplicated.
Yeah, Barry?
I was just wondering, is it okay that two of my connections that come up here says cannot obtain ownership for the connection?
Oh, I don't know why that is. Maybe some process has hidden its name, or... I'm not sure. I'd have to look that one up. But you should have seen some of them that will have shown you the ownership, at least, for couple of them.
Yeah, Dropbox and Twitter and all that kind of stuff was there.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is quite a graphic way of illustrating my point that processes make things happen on the network and services are things that actually provide services. I don't know what App Agent is, actually. You might have to Google that one up. I don't have an App Agent on my machine. Does anybody know what App Agent is?
Nah, never heard.
Well, whatever it is, I don't think I want it running all these times, so thank you for the command. I'll sort it out and kill it.
Well, possibly find out what it is before you kill it, because bad things TM might happen to your computer. But once you've figured out what it is, you can certainly kill it off. Now, so services are things that respond to network requests. Can anybody give me examples of things they might consider services? Just simple example. Anybody's able to answer this one? Example of a service that you might run on a particular machine for networky stuff.
Web server. Ventrilo server.
Yeah, web server, Ventrilo server. Yep, all those sorts of things. TeamTalk server. ZoneBBS.com. Just had to throw that one in. Okay, so you have end devices, you've got computers, laptops, workstations, mobile phones, all those sorts of things. They're the devices that people tend to carry around and use and all those sorts of things. Network printers, voice over IP phones, these are the sorts of things you can have connected on. security cameras. Yes, you can get IP-based security cameras. Wireless devices such as barcode scanners, PDAs, iPhones. There we go, iPhone made it in there. End devices are called hosts. Hosts are identified by their particular IP address. Okay, let's see how clever we are. Quiz question. Anybody know how to get the MAC address out of an iPhone?
Isn't that under the
settings about.
The about screen?
It is. It's under settings about. You go settings general about, and the MAC addresses for the Wi-Fi and the Bluetooth pop up there. And you might want to ask yourself, why would you need those MAC addresses? You know, that's just a silly thing. I mean, I've been using my iDevice for ages, or my Braille Note or Braille Lite or Braille Thing Note Taker. Why would I need its MAC address? Well, in very restrictive network environments, it is possible that you need to add the MAC address of your device to a wireless access point, or to the wireless communications infrastructure, or you may be required to register your MAC address with information technology so that your network devices can have access to the network. Okay, servers are the other reason, sorry, I'll just realize this, the other reason you might want the MAC address is if you're running a DHCP server and you want to do static allocation of IP addresses to certain devices, so you want your iPhone to always pop up on the same address so that you can always know where to FTP into it, so you can upload your Daisy books to it with Daisy Worm. That would be a reason why you'd want the IP address, the MAC address, and you'd feed that into the DHCP server. So yeah, that's all good. Any questions, comments so far? Okay, so servers are software with services on them that provide services. That's a bit tautological. Like email, web servers, that sort of stuff. We pretty much know what they are. Clients are machines that can access stuff from the server. This is all pretty pedestrian stuff. Intermediate devices are things like switches, routers, wireless access points, all that sort of stuff. They can be considered intermediate devices because they actually provide some of the connectivity linkages between the hosts and the servers. Some of the things these devices do, they generate and retransmit data, signals, they maintain pathways through the network, especially routers, notify other devices of errors and communications failures, send data along alternate pathways in case there's a link failure, classify and direct messages based on quality of service priorities. 1 second. That's better. Permit or deny the flow of data based on security settings. And they're the sort of things that those network control devices do. Has anybody played with any firewalls and things that are more complicated than your average Linksys / D-Link / Time Warner cable modem?
IP table.
Oh, yeah, they're fun. Yep. Oh, the other thing I meant to mention to you, Chris, which I just remembered is, and I didn't give you the link, I'll give it to you after lecture, I have a Dropbox link for a RouterOS virtual machine that's already pre-configured if you want to play with one. There. A lot of fun. They got web interfaces and stuff.
Yeah. Ooh, me too.
Anybody else who... Okay. Anybody else who wants to play with it, it's got 23 hours and 31 minutes of operation time, so keep the original virtual machine archive around because you're going to have to uncompress it again and use it again unless you buy a license for it. And I wouldn't recommend you buy a license for a virtual machine unless you've got a very specific reason to do so. But yeah, that's 14 megs you can grab out of my Dropbox, maybe after lecture. Very big on Mikrotik gear, but we don't get to talk about it in this course. Three types of media: copper cable, fiber, and wireless. Everybody know what fiber is? Everybody know what wireless is? Everybody know what copper cable is? Do I need to go over that stuff?
Are we going to go over the types of connectors? Because, I mean, I understand with, you know, RJ45s, but, like, my router here, one of my Cisco routers has for its... one of its serial connections, it uses like an RJ45 48 or something, and it looks identical, but it's different number of conductors or something.
Oh, really? That's unusual. I should actually show you how you can... Have you figured out... and this will be relevant to you all. But have you figured out how to find out how many interfaces and what type of interface they are on your router? Have you figured out how to make that happen yet?
Isn't just show interfaces?
show version tends to be a bit nicer because it'll just tell you what classification of interfaces without giving you all of those statistics, which can be a bit tedious. But yeah, show interfaces will do it. Show version tends to be a little bit less verbose.
Yeah, because the my one router here, I don't want to derail us too much, but yeah, my one router has a card in it. I think it's a CSU DSU card, and it, I guess the connectors on it aren't. They look like RJ45s, but they're not. They're have an extra pins in them or something.
Okay, there's all sorts of different connectors and stuff you get on routers, and depending on what sort of gear you're hooking up, depends on what sort of connectors you get. So what you generally see on routers is you see RJ45 for network, which is an 8-conductor copper cable, usually with data on 1, 2, 3, and 6 if you're only running at 100 megabit, or otherwise all pairs of use if you're running at gigabit. Then you end up with things like your console cable is also an RJ45, but instead of being a network cable, that's what we call a rollover cable. In other words, pin 1 to 8 are wired to pin 8 to 1, and then the connectors are put onto the ends of flat cable. So if you want to tell the difference between your console cables and your network cables, your console cables are usually flat and your network cables are round. Console cables will not work as network cables because they're wired differently. You then end up with things like the connectivity style of cables to things like CSU DSUs, in other words frame relay, smart serial. So you end up with connections like the V.35. I can't remember how many pins are in a V.35. It's a serial connector, and they're quite big connectors. And then you've got the smart serial, which are the little tiny thin ones that actually do like serial communications to your CSUs, DSUs. Now these links are like your ISP links, such as your frame relay, your digital data service, all that sort of stuff. So you're looking at anywhere from a few hundred kilobits to a few megabits to a T1 or an E1. And this is the sort of stuff that hooks these networks together. So we won't fixate too much on the connectors. Obviously, I'll probably help you individually with what your router apparently suppose it has, what sort of wicks and stuff it's got in it. We can work on that sort of outside class. Unfortunately, unless you've got lab gear in front of you, you're not going to get too much experience with the connectors because everything's already wired up on the remote bundle, which is an unfortunate limitation of our current course delivery strategy. I will actually do a show version at some point a little bit later, and we will show you what input that comes up with, and you can see what actual stuff is in these routers and what they do. Any other questions before we continue on a little bit further?
As long as it's okay if the last 5 minutes is not expected to be understood.
The last 5 minutes...
I'm just joking. All of the acronyms and a lot of the stuff on the hardware and connectors, I'm sure that most of us aren't supposed to grasp any of that.
Oh, no. You're not supposed to know all of these terms straight up. And the other thing to keep in mind is, if my memory serves, there is a glossary in the exploration curriculum, and it's amazing. Have a look in the glossary. It's like anything. You don't learn the terminology for an industry until you start messing around with the various bits and pieces. I mean, hell, we have enough AT you know, terminology. You start talking to people about video intercepts and braille overlays and insert 300 other terms that are supposed to make us sound really clever, but essentially just makes us sound quite complicated because it's, you know, in industry jargon. So obviously, you know, this sort of stuff will come more into clarity as we continue on throughout the course. Anyone else with concerns, queries, before I go on about how we, what sort of things we consider for media?
No, what you just said is a big relief.
Yeah, look, it's kind of difficult to sort of, because when I teach things, I tend to tell people lots of stuff and they think they need to know it all, which is not true, but there is quite a bit of it that you do need to know, and some of it you actually just need to hear so that you've got some idea of it so that things fall into place later, so that can be a bit of a challenge. Well, it can be for me anyway. Okay. If we're picking media, we're looking at the distance the media can correctly carry a signal. What sort of environment are we sticking the media in? Is it running between buildings? Is it outside? Is it inside? Is it whatever it is? The amount of data and the speed at which it needs to be transmitted. The cost of the media in the installation, that's a big one. It can be quite expensive to install fibre, but you can often look at the long-term benefits and actually consider that installing fibre would be a better thing than installing, say, Ethernet. There are also operational considerations that you can have for it, why you install media. My brother and his girlfriend live in a house and they have a network. And he was prompted to put wireless networking in because she didn't want that ugly blue cable running along the side of the dining room. So it's always good to remember that no matter what is good IT practice, there will be other mitigating circumstances that will sometimes cause you to deviate from good IT practice. Okay, the next point I have in these notes is that LANs usually cover a small area and are administered by a single administrative domain. If you're on the Cavi network, you're likely to be administered by me. If you're on your home network, perhaps you administer it. Which is always very frustrating when something devilish goes wrong with it and a message comes up going, "Your network has experienced a problem, please contact your network administrator." Sadly, talking to myself doesn't often resolve these sorts of problems. Okay, now a wide area network tend to be wide area networks, in other words, or WANs I should say, and they basically are various sites connected by long haul links, usually provided by telecommunications service providers. So you're looking at things like digital data services, frame relay, fiber, those sorts of things. Don't know if anybody saw a post from a guy called William Taylor on the list yesterday. You'll be interested to note that he's involved in a project that is responsible for throwing 802.11G signals on links that are over 20 kilometres in length. So, interesting uses of various networking technologies there. I don't think I need to tell you guys what the internet is. I think that would probably insult your intelligence, but it's a network of lots and lots and lots of little networks, and we all use it every day. Okay, that's the internet dealt with. Well, as far as what it is. ISP networks get millions of users on to a worldwide network and allow them to share data and go on Facebook and play Farmville and all those sorts of things. Does anybody remember when people only had one computer in their house, which is somewhat rare these days?
Yes, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
All right, now here's a list of things that I say in my notes are terms to know. And what I'm actually going to do this year is after I've given the lecture, because I was actually sick last week, I'm actually going to email out the notes. I'm actually going to distribute the notes after I've given the lecture so that you've actually got my fairly badly written notes to refer back to. Okay, NIC is a network interface card. They connect end devices to networks, and you connect the media to the network interface card. All sounds pretty straightforward, but believe me, when you don't have the media connected to the network interface card, all the packets fall out the end and the network doesn't work. Physical port, that's where you plug the cable in. Finding the physical port can be somewhat of a challenge, especially when you've never seen the particular laptop before and you don't know where it happens to hide its power button or its network port. An interface is a specialized device that connects the computer to the network. They can either be physical interfaces like Ethernet cards or virtual interfaces. And we don't really get into virtual interfaces right at the moment, but virtual interfaces, for example, is a way of making a server appear on, you know, 4 or 5 different IP addresses for various reasons. Network diagrams have specialized symbols that let you show these things. They're specialized symbols like everything has specialized symbols. So, for example, if you're doing circuit design, there's special symbols for an aerial, there's special symbols for an earth, there's special symbols for a resistor, transistor, that sort of stuff. Now, apparently I've said here that the 2.2.4 lab is not accessible. Did anybody try and do 2.2.4?
Which one is that, Kerry?
I have no idea. I'm looking at my notes. I'll have to look later.
I don't think it was in the folder.
No, I probably took it out. There was probably... I think it was something to do with, like, colours of packets and stuff in Wireshark. It wasn't particularly cool.
Yeah, sorry to miss that.
2.2.5 NeoTrace. You don't officially have to use NeoTrace, but it's kind of cool for sighted people because it brings up like this world map and you can see where the packets are travelling on the world map. I would encourage people to just look at the host names that come out of a regular trace route and you might have some idea as to what country they're travelling through.
It makes cool noises, though.
Oh, does it? I have to try that.
Yeah, NeoTrace makes little, like, beeping noises as it's going through each hop.
Yeah, yeah, I'll have to try that. I'm going to have to give NeoTrace the trial a shot now. We actually had a wireless sniffer that you could use. I can't remember what it was called, but it used to make the sort of swoosh swoosh noise that the Knight Rider car used to make in the early 80s as it was scanning for things, and then that was kind of cool. Very important to network design that things make cool noises. I think it was. Yeah, it was NetStumbler. Sorry, John.
With the NeoTrace, is it the 30-day demo that we should be trying out, or that's the only one I could come across was a demo of it?
Yeah, it's just a 30-day demo. You don't get NeoTrace for free.
And is it no longer developed? I couldn't find any actual anything on the McAfee site that described it.
I don't know. McAfee can be quite nasty like that. They have these products and then they just stop them, and you've got to go and sort of dig through all these weird corners of the web where you find this, you know, end of life notice or something that tells you what happened to it. they use it because it, as I said, it draws up the maps and stuff. And one of my students did actually tell me that you can actually drive it by pressing Control Y and a few other things, but it's not certainly a required utility.
Quick question. As far as the network symbols, and maybe we'll go into this later, but do we know, or is there a list somewhere what these are? I'm thinking about further down the road when I go to take these Cisco exams and need a reader, so I can sort of describe and the reader sort of knows what the heck they're looking at.
That is an interesting question, and we don't have an adequate solution for it yet. Although Pranav has said that he has a method of turning VRML diagrams into embossable tactile braille. So maybe we can shove people a VRF file and you can find... a BRF file and you guys can throw it at a tactile embosser and get an idea as to what these symbols look like. I think...
Cool.
Generally speaking, the reader is designed to know at least what the symbols are. They should be able to tell you what devices are actually connected together. But we are currently working on ways of getting knowledge of those symbols through to people. Not that it matters for this course, but everybody's aware that I think it's National Braille Press do a book that shows you what all of the Windows symbols and icons look like.
It's very cool. I used to use it as a teaching tool.
Yeah, we've got to get one, because Grace loves that visual stuff. And I wouldn't mind seeing what they look like as well. Although I must say, teaching your previously computer illiterate mother how to drive Windows is a good way to learn what everything looks like. Do I click on the dash, the X, or the square thing? I'll click on the X. No! No! Oh, sorry, it's gone now. Yeah, that's why I didn't want you to click on the X. Well, because Pranav reckons if we do it in VRML, we can emboss it on the... Well, we can emboss it on the Everest. Yes, you could. Yeah. Look, you're the boss, and you've got good ideas. I'm not going to dissuade you. Ian's got some good ideas on how to describe these symbols and what they look like, and we're going to try that. But we're also going to look into the VRML angle. So we'll let you guys know how that comes up. Yeah, we'll do both, I think. Whichever way works, we'll stick to that. Just had a random query. How many of you have access to an embosser if we were to come up with some BRF files or whatever? Or could get access to one? You don't have to own one.
I can track one down.
I have one.
I don't... Probably not. I'm not sure.
Okay, no, that's fine. We could always ship you something, articles for the blind. Such things are possible, but... Yeah, look, we're in the sad position of having an Everest basic, and we're just trying to figure out something to do with it. That's all good. Protocols. Do I need to talk about what a protocol is? The rules and regulations for communicating between different people, devices, things. Anybody here not seen Star Wars? C-3PO was a protocol droid. His job was to communicate between different races and people. Okay. The protocols depend on what sort of communications you're doing. Obviously, you modify the protocol. The smoke signal protocol is different to the carrier pigeon protocol, which is different to the protocol our ISP tends to use, which is sometimes less reliable than the aforementioned smoke signals and pigeons. A set of protocols that interoperate are called a protocol stack. In other words, a stack of protocols, they all run one on top of the other, they all interrelate, and we're going to get into this layered model stuff that we all so know and love soon. Okay, a protocol suite describes the format or structure of a message, how network devices share pathways between other network devices, so we're talking about things like routing protocols and stuff, RIP, BGP, OSPF, all that sort of stuff. When are you going to get system and error messages and how they're going to be shoveled across? How you set up and terminate data transfer sessions, etc. You can have some proprietary and specific protocols in a protocol suite. So, for example, you could have Skype. Skype's protocols in TCP/IP, and whilst the underlying protocol suite is open, Skype certainly isn't. A protocol can be technology independent if it provides, if it actually specifies how something is to be done. If it describes what needs to be done, but it doesn't describe how. So, in other words, you know, your retransmit logic and your timing logic and stuff can actually be media independent and stuff if you actually design the protocols correctly. This is important for things like timing and stuff on Ethernet, where the speed of the internet governs the timing. The speed of the Ethernet governs the timing, but the rest of the protocols and the spacings and stuff remain fairly common depending on what sort of media you're shoveling the Ethernet frames over. Ah, it looks like I can't spell benefits. Nobody's called me out on that, which is good. The benefit to layered models. Does everybody understand why we used layered models? The whole point of a layered model is so that you can change various protocols at various layers without changing the rest of the model. So, for example, you can change things at the physical layer of the OSI reference model and leave the data link, network, transport, session, presentation, and application layer untouched. You get competition because you can get stuff from all different people and you can all run it and it's all compatible with TCP/IP, etc. It limits the changes of technology changes and advancements. So, for example, the frames that you shovel over 10 megabit coaxial Ethernet are essentially the same frame as what you shovel over gigabit. So they tell me here that the difference between a protocol and a reference model is that a protocol model only shows how stuff is necessary to get the protocol to work, and the reference model shows how the protocols work. And this is why the OSI is a reference model. Any questions, comments? This actually took longer than I thought, unfortunately. Alrighty. I'm under the delusion that some of this stuff's actually important, so we'll continue on. TCP/IP standards are set by the request for comments and set on public forums. You used to be able to get the standards from internic.net, but I think they moved them. A Google for RFCs will pull them all up for you. We've got steps for protocols, so you create your data at the beginning, at the application layer of the sending device. Segmentation and encapsulation, in other words, break it up and wrap it up. Send it down the protocol stack in the source end device. Generation of the media, generation of the data onto the media at the network access layer. Transportation of the data through the internet work. Reception of the data at the network access layer of the end device. Decapsulation and reassembly of the data. And passing the data to the application at the application layer of the end device. Anybody got any questions on that? Because I'm about to do a very quick horse race style presentation of how the OSI reference model works, and then we will come back and explain it in more detail. Any queries, questions so far? Alrighty. Now, we've all read about the OSI reference model, and we know that it's got seven layers, and the first layer is the physical layer, then the data link layer, the network layer, the transport layer, the session layer, the presentation layer, and the application layer. I don't know how you guys are going to remember these. There are mnemonics such as all people seem to need data processing, which I think is just made by some data processing experts, or please do not throw sausage pizza away. That's another way of remembering physical data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application. Now, I don't know whether you guys want to just keep saying them backwards and forwards to yourself as you stand on your exercise bike or personal trainer or whatever, but you guys need to remember the seven layers of the OSI reference model somehow eventually within about 3 or 4 weeks. So, physical data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application, and hopefully go the other way. Now, these layers do different things. The physical layer is responsible for how you actually get the data from one point to another. Are we using various voltages on a wire? Are we using light on a fiber? Are we using wireless through the air? That is the physical layer. The data link layer is the data link layer is the layer that is responsible for the framing and actually breaking the network data stream into frames, and it's the local transport of that data. In other words, you know, shoveling it across local area networks and over frame relay and all of that sort of stuff. We then have the network layer, which is where you get your network-specific addresses, such as your IP address. Obviously, at the data link layer, we tend to work with MAC addresses, but at the network address layer, we tend to work with IP addresses. At the transport layer, we're responsible for our packet sequencing and our end-to-end correction and detection of errors, or possibly just detection. At the session layer, we are responsible for opening a communication session, talking on that communication session, and then shutting it down again. Then we have the presentation layer, which is responsible for things like character set conversion and those sorts of things. Also can be deal with encryption and data compression. And then we have application layers, which is where your applications actually talk to the OSI reference model. Has she turned all your heads to goo yet? Have you turned all their heads to mush yet?
I think we
have. Okay. So, is everybody somewhat familiar with the OSI reference model? And we are going to talk about it a lot more, but is everybody somewhat familiar with the basic overview? Now, if you're anything like me and they tell you that there's this 7-layer OSI reference model and you're just like, but what? Why are there 7 layers? And that all sounds so incredibly complicated. The only way I can make it better is picture an incredible, yummy chocolate sponge cake. So at the bottom layer, you've got like the cake base. And then above that, you've got a layer of chocolate. And then above that, you've got some cream. And then above that, you've got some chocolate sprinkles. And then on top of that, you've got some, like, you know, macaroon chocolate biscuits. And it's not as much fun as the OSI reference model, but it's certainly a very yummy layered model. And if you eat that cake, which I would certainly like to do at this point, you will your teeth will go through all the way through all of the layers, and you will have a very yummy taste experience. Now, back to the OSI reference model. So, what they're talking about is each protocol data unit, which is what we call the stuff at the various layers of this model. There are actually about 4 or 5 of them. These are something that you will eventually want to know. The data is the name of the protocol data unit for the information that is at the application layer. So in other words, your application sends in data at the top of the level, and it goes down through all the layers, through the network, and back up the other side of the network system. A segment is the transport layer PDU. In other words, they're our data segments. They've actually got to be sequenced and reassembled, and that's where all your windowing and all that sort of stuff comes in, which we'll talk about later. A packet is your internetwork layer PDU. In other words, the network layer of the OSI reference model, layer 3. Frame is your network access layer or your data link layer. And bits is your PDU, which is used on the physical layer, which is obviously, it's very important that there's actually a question in the data, a question in the test that says, organize the following PDUs into the correct order. Segments, packets, data, segments, data, packets, bits, and you've actually got to pick the solution that actually lines them up into the correct order from application layer down. So be aware there is going to be one question in your tests that will cause a little bit of brain strain. Any questions so far? And more importantly, is me talking about it making it make any more sense to anyone?
It is, yeah.
Oh, good. Well, I always find that reading the notes is a bit sort of terrifying, and Eloquence or your synthesizer of choice or your Braille display of choice will rattle out all of this information and you're sort of left going, yeah, what? All right, so here's this aforementioned aforementioned example that I'm going to give. So say, for example, I'm sending an email to Barry. I don't know why I'm... Oh, I'm marking one of his labs. That's a good reason. I'm sending him an email, right? So I sit in front of my copy of Mozilla Thunderbird and I hit send on the email. Well, the first thing that happens is that the email is injected into the application layer. The application layer is responsible for injecting the email into the network system. The application layer sends the email down to the presentation layer. The presentation layer is responsible for character set conversion, encryption, data compression, etc., especially considering file attachments and that sort of thing. The presentation layer then sends this information down into the session layer, which is responsible for the opening and closing of the email session between me and the mail server. The session layer then transmits the data down into the transport layer, which concerns itself with the segmentation of the network of the message and how the message is going to be broken into segments and is going to be sequenced and sent across the network to the end to the other end of the network solution. The network layer is responsible for the end-to-end addressing. So what IP address does my computer have? What IP address does Barry's computer have? The data is going to go down the layer and it's going to be sent from my IP address and it's going to travel down into the data link layer. The data link layer is going to be responsible for the framing and the lower level error correction and retransmission on the lower level medium. The data is then going to be sent down to the physical layer, which is then converted into bits, bytes, electrical voltages, whatever, and sent across the network. Then, when the message gets to Barry's place, it's going to turn up on the physical layer. His computer is going to take all the bits and bytes and voltages off the wire. The data is going to go back up through the data link layer, where the segments are going to, the frames are going to be looked at. And the frames will be able to be checked for validity and sent into the network stack, whereupon those frames will be handed up to the network layer, which will then be responsible for making sure that the packets are destined to the right address and the addresses are correct for the source and destination and that sort of thing. Then it's going to be sent up to the transport layer, where the segments are going to actually be reassembled and converted back into a data stream, which is then going to go back to the session layer, which is the one that decides whether the sessions are open and closed, which is then going to go up to the presentation layer, which is where we deal with all our file conversion stuff, all the way up to the application layer, whereupon Barry receives the email. The end. Whoever thought sending it... No, that's what the recording's for. And yes, I can. But let's not. Yeah, pretty much. We used to have a supermarket sweep over here, actually. But that's to give you some idea of the entire overview of the process. I don't expect you all to be able to go and do that at the end of the course unless you really want to as a neat party trick. Although it can be really infuriating to do that to people when they say the internet's not working and then you can whip through the OSI reference model and then ask them at the end where they think the problem is in the OSI reference model. Make sure you're running very fast in the other direction when you do that. any questions? Okay, now we are talking about the comparisons of the TCP and OSI reference models. Now, the TCP model came out before the OSI reference model, and it has four layers. It has network access, network, transport, and application. Network access is how you get stuff onto the media that you're going to communicate over. Network is the layer that deals with your IP addresses and your routing protocols and that sort of thing. Transport is where you do with your packet sequencing and reassembly. And application is the layer that deals with getting the information into the TCP/IP reference model. Any questions on that? Okay, so the OSI reference level application relates to the TCP/IP application. Application. They're both applications. We don't worry about that. The presentation is part of the application layer as well. You will find that layers 7, 6, and 5 all refer to the TCP/IP application layer. All right? Transport maps to transport, network maps to network, and network access maps to the bottom two layers, data link and physical. Any questions on that? Which is partially a question and partially an excuse for me to get more coffee. Okay, here we go. Everybody's pretty clear with networking addresses. You've all seen IP addresses. You've all seen hardware addresses. MAC addresses exist at layer 2 of the OSI reference model, or the network access layer of the TCP/IP model. And IP addresses exist at the network layer. Anybody tell me how many bits are in a MAC address?
Isn't it 64?
No, 48.
48.
Ah, okay. The first chunk is the manufacturer, right, of the hardware?
The first 24 bits of the hardware address are the OUI, or Organizational Unique Identifier. And if you've got something like, what is it? If you've got something like Wireshark, or I think SmartSniff can do some of it, although you've got to put a better Ethers file in, you can actually look at the packets that it's capturing, and one of the things that it'll tell you is who made the network card. okay, so 48 bits in a MAC address, usually written as 6 two-digit hexadecimal numbers separated by dashes, colons, dots, or sometimes spaces. So, 00, colon, 00, colon, 1B, colon, 1D, colon, 28, colon, 34. That was the MAC address of the first network card that I ever owned. It was a true blue Novell Anthem NE2000. I don't know whether anybody here is old enough to remember what they were, but they were an ISA network card, and mine had a BNC coax connector and an AUI connector on it. And I spent 4 days trying to figure out why my Ethernet wouldn't work, went down to the local computer shop, and found out there was a short in my piece of coax. now, layer 2 addresses are unique for a specific local network, so MAC address technically only has to be unique for the local area network that it's actually connected on, whereas layer 3 addresses actually require information to tell it which network the actual machines are actually on. And we'll talk about how we break TCP/IP networks. Oh, yes, there was more to that sentence. We will talk about how we break TCP/IP networks into the network address, the host portion, and how we do all the subnetting. The port number tells you what application is using a particular connection. So, for example, 80 for HTTP, 443 for HTTPS, 143 for IMAP, 993 for secure IMAP, 465 for secure SMTP, all that sort of stuff. Ooh, and that's the end of my notes. Oops, that took far longer than I anticipated. Anybody got any questions? But I think there was some important stuff in there.
I'm certainly glad it took longer than the 12 minutes.
Yeah, your explanation of the layers and the comparison between the OSI and TCP, that helps a lot. It's a lot clearer now than it was.
Oh, I can do it in 12 minutes if you like, but I'm pretty sure none of you will enjoy the experience. And I'm not quite that unkind, but yes, I have done these things in very limited time before. In the early days of Cavi, we would get to 10 minutes from the end and still have about 5 pages of ITE1 material to go through, and I would sum up the end of the lecture very, very quickly and rapidly, which would have two benefits. One would be to get through the material, and the second would be to wake all the students up.
Yeah, that's the point whenever everyone turns around and goes, oh, was I meant to actually be paying attention?
Yeah, my teacher's aide had this wonderful way of sort of reading through all of this history stuff, and then halfway through, like, reading about, like, the Great Plague, she'd be like, oh, and you're not listening to a word I'm saying, am I, Carrie? Are you, Carrie? And I'd be like, ah, yeah, yes, I was. Yes, I was. No, I wasn't. Okay, we'll run that tape back.
An assistant of mine who was taking notes for me in uni, he used to actually put either funny things in or questions in or throw something random into the middle of my notes just to make sure that I was actually reading the notes and he wasn't just handing me them and I was throwing them down the toilet.
I think that's a very wise thing to do. Alright, so... do we want to... do you want me to drop Jaws on here and we'll have a little bit of a play with the... a very short play with the remote bundle so we've got something a little bit fun to do this morning, or... I know we wanted to talk a little bit about Smart Sniff, which is probably worth mentioning. I'll get you guys the exact module where we talk about Smart Sniff because I've actually got all the files and they're easily grabbable. the other thing is that I would mention is, and this is completely 100% optional. But if anybody actually wants a DVD of the exploration materials off the server or similar, that can actually be posted to you, if that would be a way of you getting a lot more of the information a lot more quickly. So these things are possible. Maybe you can just download it yourself, but we do also provide that if you need it.
How much do you charge for that?
Probably the cost of the postage, I'd say. So whatever the international postage on something the size of a DVD would be.
And if you want a copy, just email you at the exploration address?
Yeah, pretty much. And then I can put that on there and any other things. For example, you might want our virtual machine, our Windows XP virtual machine, so I might be able to give you the virtual machine and the copy of VMware Player and the and the actual... and the actual exploration material. Now, that is a snapshot. Keep in mind that there may be changes made to the online resources, but it's a pretty good starting point.
Yeah, it would be handy to have that there, just because there is occasions where we don't have access to online. Gary, actually, before you go into anything else important, can I take and I promise it'll be no longer than this, a 2-minute smoke break?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have to duck down and take care of a very personal problem down in the room of requirement. So would you guys be okay if I'd be back in about 1 or 2 minutes? Because that would be kind of nice, and I will come straight back and finish off.
Sounds good.
All right, anybody got any general questions while we're waiting?
So, Carrie, are you going to go over the virtual bundle? Because that might be helpful just to get an overview of that.
Oh, my word, yes. But I was waiting to see when Barry's finished his cigarette so that he can listen as well. So I was just seeing if there's any other general questions while that was happening. But I can start fairly soon and go on the virtual bundle.
What type of serial server is that you're using? I'm trying to figure out if it's the same one that I used to have that I tossed out. Do you know what it is?
It's a black box. Ian, what sort of serial server are we using? What's it called? Black box what? Oh, okay. Console switch. Ian's just having a look. Black box console. What? Remote port manager? Yeah. 724-746-5500. It's a remote console switch. That's what we're using. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, that's the same number that's on the power management switch as well to make things confusing. So basically what... Probably a series of stuff made by Black Box. So essentially what it's got is it's got 16 9-pin male RS-232 ports, it's got a network interface, a set of DIP switches to set the default baud rate for console/control port number 1, and it's got an IEC power connector, and that's what it is. Alright, I'm going to make a start on this remote bundle stuff, we will... Sorry. We will let people who aren't here catch up because I want to start showing this stuff. Let's see if I can break this. Okay. I'm audible, am I?
Yep.
Yes.
Alrighty. Here comes Jaws.
Main menu, setup button.
Okay, here's JAWS.
Windows 10 desktop, folder view is new, Dropbox, 4761.
Oh, it's breaking up a little bit, and I've got to figure out my buffering to stop that from happening. I think we're just going to have to...
Exact audio copy. Free download manager.
Oh.
Exact audio copy.
That's not very nice, but we'll just have to... I think we'll just have to deal with that and see how we go. Okay, so what we're going to do...
TTPI mount. TTPI view. TTPI.
We're going to go in
enter.
Here.
File edit setup control window resize help. Terraform dashboard bracket disconnected by bracket PT. Terraform colon new connection dialog. Host colon edit combo bracket 160 alt plus T. File edit setup control window resize help. 190.
Now I'm going to go into the remote IP address of the bundle, the local IP address of the bundle, which is
100.1.1.1.144.
Which you guys are going to go into www.qcat.org, and you're going to go in as Telnet.
144.
So, up arrow to change that to Telnet, and hit enter. Now, it doesn't actually speak that prompt for reasons that I've never been able to figure out. So, it's asking me for a password. Okay, so everybody gets the idea that we've got router 1, switch 1, workstation 1, and workstation 2. Everybody cool with that at the moment? I'm sorry about the crackles. I need to muck with my latencies in the repeaters, but I can't do that now.
What password did you use there? Was that the normal password that we would use, or was it something?
I used what we call the administrator password, and that gives me access to all 16 ports on the switch. You guys will tend to use the passwords pod 1, pod 2, pod 3, or power, which power needs to be configured, which will give you access to... So pod 1 is router 1, switch 1, workstation 1, workstation 2. Pod 2 is router 2, workstation 2, router 2, switch 2, workstation 3, workstation 4. Pod 3 is switch 3, router 3, workstation 5, workstation 6. So the remote bundle is split into three different pods so that you can all work together on it and actually be able to utilize the different pods and stuff. So some of you can work on one pod, some of you can work on the other pod and set up the different sections of the bundle. So there is a help screen that you can pull up from this thing, but effectively to connect to a particular port, we would connect to, say, port 3. So if I use my JAWS cursor, so JAWS cursor, route JAWS to PC, and you go up.
Enter slash H command. 16 vertical, 15 vertical, 14 vertical, 13 vertical, 12 vertical, 11 vertical, 10 vertical, 0, 9 vertical, bar 0, 8, 0, 0, 6, 0, 5 vertical, bar 0, 4 vertical, 0, 3 vertical, bar router 1 vertical, bar left, 9 right, 7 vertical, bar 3 vertical, bar any vertical, bar 0.
See how it says 0, 3, router 1, defined, free, any. It means that nobody's using it. The password is defined for that port. The password for that port happens to be pod 1, just out of curiosity. And we can connect to that by doing /C3.
Slash C3, enter, connected 0, 3, colon, router 1. That is connected, enter, colon, carry D.
Okay, connected to router 1. To disconnect, press Control B. If you forget everything else, remember the disconnect key. To disconnect, Control B. B for break back out.
Enter chocolate grater.
This router is called chocolate. See how the prompt is chocolate grater?
Enter chocolate grater.
I hope that's not breaking up too much for you guys.
Enter chocolate grater.
Now, if I log out of this router...
It's enter chocolate con 0 is now available.
See, it says chocolate con 0 is available. Press return to get started.
Enter. Chocolate grater.
And I'm now back into the router. Everybody cool with that button much so far?
The C3 command? I didn't follow where that came from.
Slash C means connect, and port 3 is the port on the serial switch.
Okay.
So if I break back...
Control D is connected. Port status colon version 3.0, site ID colon status bundle, port vertical bar name vertical bar password vertical bar status vertical bar mode vertical bar buffer count dash 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 plus dash.
Okay, so port name status blah 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 blah. If I go back up here,
0 6 vertical blank 0 5 vertical 0 4 vertical bar 0 3 vertical bar router 1 vertical bar left defined right vertical bar 3 vertical bar any vertical bar 0.
See 0 3 router 1 defined free any. That is port 3. So if I go slash if I go down one
0 4 vertical bar switch 1 vertical bar left defined right defined vertical bar 3 vertical bar any vertical bar 0.
Port 4 is switch 1. So if I go slash C4.
PC cursor. Slash C4 enter connected 0 4 colon switch 1. So disconnect enter colon guarantee. Enter, switch one,
and I'm now connected to switch 1. So let's now try going to, say, one of the Linux workstations. So we'll break out of here.
Control B is connected.
Control B. We'll go slash C5.
Slash C5, enter connected 0 5 colon WKS1. So disconnect enter colon guarantee. Enter Ubuntu 9.10 WKS1 IS 0 WKS1 log and colon.
Okay, so we're on a Ubuntu 9.1 workstation. Username CAVI.
Copy, enter password colon.
Password CAVI.
Copy, enter, mask log and colon, mod 8315
Okay, that's a Linux box. Sudo
su.
CAVI.
Copy, enter,
we are now sitting at the root prompt of a Linux workstation where we can check out our Ethernet configuration, etc. Is there going to be documentation for the remote bundle? Yes. I've been busy coughing and curling up in bed, which is why it hasn't actually been fleshed out. But I will be documenting the base Linux commands that you need to actually use. Any questions so far?
No, just a comment. It's really cool. I'm looking forward to this part.
Oh, most people do. We do like the remote bundle. So if, for example, I want to, for example, look at how the Ethernet interface on this is configured, just to give you some idea, ifconfig eth0.
S0 link enter colon Ethernet H1 00 colon 0 C colon 29 colon 09 colon C colon 72 bin 6 and colon A colon 20 C colon 29 F colon A09 colon C72 slash 64 so colon link up broadcast running multicast MTU colon 1500 colon 1 RX packets colon 26500 8 colon 0 drop colon 0 overrun colon 0 frame colon 0 TX packets colon 10 colon 0 drop colon 0 overrun colon 0 carrier colon 0 collision colon 0 smooth colon 1000 RX packets colon 9,90,360 left pair 9.0 MD right pair TX bit S colon 1836 left pair 1.8 AD right pair interrupt colon 19 base MS colon 0 X 2000 WKS1 colon slash home slash copy number.
And that basically told us that it had an IPv6 link local address configured on it, which you weren't meant to know, and there is actually no IP address configured on that particular interface. So there's no IP address configured on the workstations. How we talk to the workstations is via a serial console so that we can reconfigure all of the network hardware on those workstations. Now, if I break back to the router...
Control B is connected. Port status colon version 3.0. Site ID colon status bundle. Port vertical bar name vertical bar password vertical bar status vertical bar mode vertical.
Let's go back into the router, which is slash C3.
Slash C3. Enter. Connected 03 colon router 1. So disconnect enter colon guarantee. Enter. Complete creator.
Now, remember Jason was asking how does he know what sort of ports he's actually got in his router? You can do a show interfaces, but there is an easier way of doing this. You go enable to become the super user.
Enable. Enter. Chocolate number.
See how the prompt has changed to chocolate number sign.
Yep.
Alrighty. Now, if I do a show version.
Show. Version enter. Cisco software 2800 software left parent 2800 M dash security 9 dash M right parent. Version 12.4 left parent 11 right parent T2. Release software. E left parent FC4 right parent. Technical support colon. HTTP colon slash slash www.cisco.com slash tech support. Copyright left parent C right parent 196 dash 2007 Cisco systems. In compile monitoring dash 0717 36 iPod underline team. ROM colon system bootstrap. Version 12.4 left parent 13 R right parent T. Release software left parent FC1 right parent. Chocolate up time is 2 weeks. 1 day 7 hours 19 minutes. System return to time is 2 weeks. 1 day 7 hours 19 minutes. System return to ROM by power dash on. System limit stylus port slash colon C2800 M dash security K9-MZ124-11T2.info. This product contains cryptographic features and is subject to United States and local country laws. Over import, export, transfer and use. Delivery of Cisco CR. If the graphic product does not apply, third party authority to import, export, distributor use encryption. Importers, exporters, as distributors and users are responsible for. C. Compliance with U.S. and local country laws. By using this product, you agree to comply with applicable laws and regulations. If you are unable to comply with U.S. and local laws, return this product immediately. Summary of U.S. laws governing Cisco cryptographic products may be found at colon dash dash more dash dash. http://www.cisco.com/www/export/crypto/tools/tqrg.html. If you require further assistance, please contact us by sending email to export@cisco.com. Cisco 2811 left fair version 53.5 lower right fair with 249,856K/12,288K bytes of memory. Processor 4 IDFHK 1050F1K. 2 fastier interfaces. 2 0 left fair slash sync right fair interfaces. 1 virtual private network left fair VPN right fair module. RAM configuration 64 bits right with fair enabled. 239K bytes of non-dash volatile configuration memory. 62,720K bytes of compact slash left fair need slash right fair configuration register 0x2102. Chocolate number.
Okay, let's go and have a look at some of that in more detail.
Cisco 2811.
Okay, that is how much memory is in the actual router. So 256 meg, and then there's, I'm not sure what the 12 meg is for. The processor board is not important. Two fast Ethernet interfaces. Two serial interfaces, sync slash asynchronous.
One
virtual private network module.
RAM configuration is 64 bits wide with parity enabled.
And it's telling me that the DRAM is 64 bits wide with parity enabled.
239K bytes of non-dash volatile configuration memory.
239K of non-volatile configuration memory.
62,720K bytes of compact flash.
And it's got some ATA compact flash. In other words, it's got a 64 meg compact flash card in there.
Configuration register 0x2102. PC cursor.
So may I strongly suggest, Jason, that you run a show version on your routers to find out what they actually have. And it's completely up to you, but you actually may want to make a list of what all your routers have got so that you have some idea of what you're dealing with and what sort of bits and pieces you happen to have. Because it's very difficult to build a Meccano set if you don't know what all the bits do. And that's true for any network subsystem. I'm not just picking on you. Don't take it personally.
Yeah, can I shoot the config over to you, and just maybe you can help me decipher it? Because, like I said, I know for a fact I've got serial interfaces, but like I said, they're not V35 connectors. They're actually, like I said, what look like RJ45s, but aren't.
Yeah, we can certainly do that. Do you guys know how to save? Has anybody looked in TerraTerm? Do you guys all know how to save output of stuff in TerraTerm, or should I go through that? Because it's kind of nifty to know.
Please do. I have it installed, but that would be helpful.
Okay, so you pull down the file menu.
Left menu, file menu, new connection, dot, dot, duplicate session, alt, plus G, segment, connection, alt, plus G, log, dot, 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 L.
Log. Hit enter.
Enter menu bar. Leave menu bar. TerraTerm, colon, log, dialog. File name, colon, edit, TerraTerm, dot, log, alt, plus N. File edit, setup, control, window, resize,
L. Okay, file name, TerraTerm, dot, log, so I'll just call it guff, dot, log.
Log, tab, save with type, colon, combo box, all left, parent, star right, parent, one, tab, save button, alt, plus S, space, 192.168.
Now, you can tell whether you're logging because there's another window that's popped up here.
Alt, tab, chat. Alt, tab, record, slash, playback, alt, tab, ventrilo. Alt, tab, TerraTerm, colon, log. TerraTerm, colon, log, dialog. Ice transfer, colon, zero. File name, colon, read only, edit, dot, log. Tab, fullback, colon, read only, edit, backslash, program, file, backslash, TerraTerm, backslash, dot, log. Tab, close button. Tab, pause button, alt, plus S. Tab, help button, alt, plus H. Tab, file name, colon, read only, edit,
so you can pause and you can close the log. So I'll go back into my TerraTerm window.
Alt, tab, 192.168.100.144:23. Enter, chocolate number. Show. Version, enter, Cisco, yellow, software, 2600, top, pound, colon, backslash, more.
You don't need to hear all that.
Space, HTTP, colon, and register, zero.
And that should have done that. Now, if I go back into my log window.
Alt, tab, TerraTerm, colon, log. TerraTerm, colon, log, dialog. Ice transfer, colon, 1724. File name, colon, read only, edit, log. Tab, fullback, colon, read only, edit, backslash, program, file, backslash, TerraTerm, backslash, log. Tab, close button.
Okay, does everybody understand how that works? We've received 1,700 bytes. It's stored in a file called guff.log. It's given you the full path. And that file will open in Notepad. Let's stop logging.
Space, 192.168.100.144.
I just hit spacebar on the close button. You can also put comments in the log file. And you can view the log and all that sort of stuff. Now, I hate to sound, I hate to sound a bit, but the help in TerraTerm is actually quite good. So if you get stuck, it's a Windows help file. Do use it. I do. A lot. Now, the only other thing I need to tell you about... Oh, we're almost out of time. The only other thing I need to tell you about the remote bundle is that when the documentation gets tidied up, it is going to actually have a list of how the remote bundle is actually cabled. Essentially, pod 2 is what we call the ISP pod. It provides the clock signal for the other two pods, pods 1 and 3. Pods 1 and pod 3 are connected to the ISP pod, which is pod 2. So to get traffic from router 1 all the way through to router 3, you need to route it through the ISP. Am I going to do a horrible hands-on practical lab with you all on how to make that happen? Yes. Okay? So get ready for that, because that's going to be a lot of fun, and everybody's going to learn a lot. But you'll certainly be more comfortable with the Cisco gear. Any pending questions on the remote bundle as much as I've shown you this week? Yes.
Enter chocolate number.
So when you you were working in pod 1 and you took us into the workstation at one point and then you disconnected, is that it, or is there any type of tidiness or tips we need to know? As far as I'm thinking, like, I didn't see you log out of that session. Is there still a session open, or does that happen when you disconnected?
That session, that's a good question. That session is actually open, so if I break back and go /C5. Woohoo, naughty me. I'm still logged in, so I go exit.
Exit, enter, exit,
exit. I'm out. So I'm at TIS1 login. Now if I go, if I break back here,
control B is connected.
/C3.
Enter, connected, 03 code. Enter, chocolate number.
And then go exit.
Exit, enter, chocolate com 0 is now available. Please return to get started.
I am logged out. We will teach you how to save your configurations into log files and stuff. It is very important that if you are working on a particular pod, that you put yourself in the pod on Ventrilo so that other students don't step on your work. Also, it is important that you back up your configuration files and be able to put them back so that if somebody else works on the remote bundle whilst you're not working on it, you won't lose all your hard work, and we will teach you guys how to do that. If you break one of the routers by erasing the flash, or something like that, I will personally be sitting down and making you fix it, which will be instructional, and mildly unpleasant, but not impossible. So please do not execute erase flash. That is just really tedious. Yeah, Ian said if you really, really, really insist on continuing to erase the flash, we'll make you fix it via dial-up modem, and that'll take 16 hours. So please do not erase the flash if you can help it. Yes, John.
Does the course get into the different commands and how the routers are configured and things like that, or is that supplemental, more material to the notes?
Just let me switch away from my JAWS because I think I'm done with that for the moment. Let's close out of here. Oh, to get out of the remote switch, you control B to break back, and then you go /X.
Slash X, enter, is connected.
Okay, I'll just drop in the switch away from JAWS.
Ventrilo dialog, username server ID /X, MIT /X, setup button.
Okay, here we go, I'm back. I've just got to switch JAWS away from this, though. UO, default sound card, go. Right. No, it doesn't take a... breaking a router is quite difficult to do. To actually erase flash is a pretty nasty thing to do, and it will actually warn you. So I don't think you're necessarily going to break it, but I do tell people that that's the command I don't want them to execute so that they don't, and we're hoping that you're all older than kindergarten age. That means that I've actually told you not to do something, so you're all going to turn around and do it. Yes, we are going to get into the commands that configure the routers. We are going to get into the commands that configure the workstations. We are going to get into what an interface is, what a device is, whether an interface is up, whether an interface is down, a routing table, a MAC table, an ARP table. This is Lecture 2. We are going to get there. But in Lecture 2, we probably haven't made it in that general direction yet. Yes, Matthew.
So, considering how far we've got tonight, and I saw your email, that means you would like labs for Module 2 by next week, but you're not necessarily expecting the ones for Module 3, since we haven't got that far?
That is correct. I realize that you guys sort of won an extra week, and for those of you who've done the labs for Module 2, you can start on the ones for Module 3. I mean, you can rest and do something, you know, if you've already done the ones for 2, but, you know, keep working if you want. Do as many of them as you can, or at least have a look at them. But I expect the labs for Module 3 by... Sorry, the labs for Module 2 by Next week, so in 7 days from now, and I will be posting a message to the announce list specifying that as a task list.
And when do you expect the ones for three?
I expect the ones for module 3 by the week after next.
Okay, thanks.
And you'll let us know, Curry. I think you said you'll chase down the information about SmartSniff so that you don't have to go through it tonight, especially if it's already been done. I'm happy to listen to it if you can point us in the right direction for the last lab of Module 2.
Yeah. I actually have access to the entire directory, so I can enqueue them. I can enqueue them all on Winamp, and I can tell you exactly which file it's in, and you guys can get it. So I'll post that. Now, the other question I wanted to ask just before I hit, any other pending questions at this point before I hit stop on the record, because this is the sort of the official lecture material over with.